Hello, this is KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM on your radio dial. You can also listen to us online at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. Have you ever wondered who the people are that you see every day around town? The elves helping out Santa at the tree lighting at the fountain. What about the people working at the food bank week in and week out, whether there's a holiday or not? The guys throwing the ropes on the ferry, no matter how bad the weather gets. This show, Our Town, profiles some of the fascinating people who live and work in Port Townsend. We talk with people who make up the eclectic mix of Jefferson County. We talk about their lives, their dreams, and how they ended up on the northwestern edge of the USA. We'll be talking with firefighters and foodies, bus drivers and teenage beauty queens. We'll find out what makes them tick and what they think about living and working in Port Townsend. Listening to Our Town is a way to meet some of Port Townsend's authentic and even eclectic people, your neighbors, your friends, and particularly the people you don't know yet, but you'd like to meet them. Today we're going to be talking with Daniel Knudsen, a man who is something of a legend around the kitchens of this town. Daniel, more or less, drifted into town in the 70s and never really left. He's worked as a chef at a long string of restaurants and is currently part of the team at Key City Fish. He's also a man who's had a lot of experience with another side of Port Townsend. He's been a witness to a few paranormal events, but that's not really what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, Marianne. How are you today?
Good, good.
I wanted to say I hope that the firefighting and the culinary end don't get mixed together. know, no, that could not be good.
No, we don't want any fires in the kitchens at Port Townsend. But everyone has had a few bad experiences in the kitchen. But hopefully today you're going to give us some tips for having some really good experiences in your holiday kitchen. So I want to lay out a couple of different scenarios. What about if you are a young couple and you just recently got together and this holiday is the first big event, you're going to host it in your tiny little spot, and you've got both sides of the family coming, some who you know, some who you don't know. So let's talk a little bit about what menu might work. Hypothetically, we've got 20 to 25 people crowding into our tiny little apartment.
Well, that can be a fear in itself. I think that there's a lot of ways of dealing with that scenario. The best way is to go with something that the rest of the family's familiar with. It's always easy to do a turkey, but a lot of times if you want to expedite that situation, you can go with something called a spatchcock turkey, where you take the backbone and the breastplate out and it lays flat.
So Wait a minute. I wouldn't know how to do that.
Well, that's why I'm here.
Ah.
You can have me do that for you anytime, any day. But you roast it flesh side down with the skin side up. It takes a lot less of your oven. It's like half the time that you would usually spend cooking a turkey, and you can do it on a bed of apples, or you can do it a bed of apples and the dressing that you use as well underneath the turkey. You cook it for about half the time that you would a full bird, you
know. Regular turkey.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting. But of course, if this turkey is basically cut in half, lying down on your pan, you can't put stuffing in it. So what do you do with your stuffing?
Well, here's what I did this year, which I highly recommend. You make your dressing the day before, and what I did was I put it in little bread pans. Therefore, you have two options. You can put it in the oven in your bread pans and bake it up that way. Or as I did, I took it and cut it into 1-inch slices and pan seared it before I served my turkey and put the pan seared dressing on the plate and then put the sliced turkey on top of that. It enhances the moisture of the turkey and it also gives a nice flavor for the rest of the meal.
Okay, I'm not completely sure I understand mm-hmm. this. So you go ahead and you bake the dressing, right?
Yes.
And so when you're cutting it into these squares, it's all cooked, right?
Well, actually, when you're making a dressing, what you're doing is you're searing your mirepoix, the aromatics, which is celery, carrots, and onions, till they're tender, and you're using a chicken stock and whatever else. What I did was a sweetbread, an apricot with fresh basil, and once you put it in the pans themselves, it's literally already cooked. So you're just pressing it overnight to make it nice and firm. So that way you have two options again. You can either bake it that way because you don't have the ability to put it inside of your turkey. So then you can either serve it turned out as the bread pan, or as I did, I took and seared it in hot olive oil and made it crisp like a polenta, where you can use that as your base for where you're going to lay your proteins on.
Okay, so you put it on the plate under the turkey.
Yes.
Okay, now in this traditional type meal that we're talking about, we've got dressing and we've got turkey. What would you suggest, you know, as complementary to that meal?
Well, again, I love using sweet potatoes or yams, as they're called, but I'm not really fond of putting them in a really deep, syrupy, marshmallowy thing. I like to use them. You know, you can add them with just doing as a mashed potato. You're going to have the regular garlic mashed potatoes, or you can do that same thing with your yams and not have them so overcooked. Have them actually, you want to steam them so that they're still falling apart, and just add a butter and salt and pepper to them. I find that very complimentary because you've already kind of elaborated on the taste of the turkey by using your dressing and searing it. So you want to keep it simple other than that. And then there's always, of course, fresh green beans, you know. There's traditional ways that most people have been taught by their mom or dad, whoever does the seasonal cooking. So mm-hmm. that kind of ties the dinner in with the legend of the family, you might say, you know, the culinary abilities that they've had.
Okay, what about cranberry sauce?
I love cranberry sauce.
And how do you recommend doing it?
Well, I like to start from fresh cranberries, grind them. I like to put lemon and orange zest. I'll get mandarin oranges, either canned or not. Add that to it, and then you heat that up. And then there are things called French gelatin slices that you can heat. You take them, soak them in warm water, and then they dissolve. And you mix that in with your cranberry sauce, and then it sets up like an aspic or jello.
Huh, interesting.
Very nice.
Okay, so for this traditional meal, then we have the turkey, the spatchcock turkey,
right,
which is splayed open. Mm-hmm. We have the dressing, which we've cooked sort of as a polenta. And then we have the yams, and we have the green beans.
Perfect,
and
yeah.
The cranberry sauce. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I think that would probably do it.
What about dessert?
That's what I was just going to say, was a fun opposite side of a pecan pie, or a pumpkin pie, something I like to do, which is a sweet potato pie, which is more of a southern favorite. The way I learned to do that was when I was in the military. I happened across this bar down in Seaside, California, which was predominantly black, and I went in and I had this sweet potato pie that just blew me away. So I thought, I'm going to go in and find out about this. Well, I walk into the bar, and it's all elderly black men, everybody. And I'm like, okay. And I'm kind of starting to knock at the knees. And I go to the end of the bar to the gentleman that owns the establishment. And he kind of looked at me and goes, what can I do for you, young man? And I'm like, sir, this may sound odd, but this is the best sweet potato pie that I've ever had in my life. And I was wondering if you might share the recipe with me. And he got the biggest smile on his face, and he said, son, that was my great-great-grandmother's recipe, and just for you coming in here and asking, I would be glad to share it with you. So I was given probably one of the best desserts I've ever had. And basically, it's just sweet potatoes, some molasses, some brown sugar, some butter, but just the way that he made it was phenomenal. It comes out just like a pumpkin pie, a little richer, a little sweeter, but just delightful.
Okay. Now, do you go for the pie a la mode? Do you put ice cream or whipped cream?
Any which way. Even the whipped cream, which I always recommend whipping your own cream. But
yes.
There's so much to do.
I've not had the best luck whipping cream. What's the secret?
The best whipping cream, you're going to look for a 40% whipping cream fat. So it's a whipping cream in the dairy aisle, and they'll have percentages on it. The more the percentage, the less you have to whip it, and the longer it'll stay peaked. So I always do just a touch of real vanilla, some white sugar, and just a really good food processor that will whip it up. And then you just go for, once you see it start peaking, then you're going to save it, put it in the fridge. Because if you go past the whipped process of that where it's starting to peak, then you're going to go from that to sweet butter, because that's exactly what butter is made out of, is that same rich, fatty whipping cream, just gone a little bit further. And believe me, I've done that.
Wow. Well, you know, sometimes people make mistakes, particularly when they're young. My first Thanksgiving, where I was the hostess, and I was in my early 20s, I invited over a bunch of people, and I sort of knew there was a pouch of stuff inside the turkey, but what I didn't know is there were actually two. And things got a little out of hand. Am I the only person in the world who's ever done that?
No, that's quite common, actually. Luckily, they put those in a food-grade paper sack now instead of a plastic one. But there, you'll find that they put your giblets not only in the turkey cavity where you're going to put your dressing, but also in the front where the neck goes up is a large flap of skin. So you want to check both front and back to make sure you got all that out. And if you don't recover it when you first get your turkey, you're really losing out on a lot of what could be going in the gravy for flavor, you know. So if by chance that you find out that you haven't found it and you have already cooked your bird, if you pull it out, you can still take that cooked product and put it in a food processor and still add it to your gravy no matter how late it is.
Wow, I never even thought of that.
The later that it is, the more processing you want to do.
Uh-huh, yeah. Okay.
But still, that's a desired flavor for doing your gravies and your stocks.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Now, I've suffered through a few turkey dinners where the turkey is way overdone. Ooh. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, as a seasoned chef, I like to make sure that I have a meat thermometer. I don't check it all the time. But, you know, in the process of doing your turkey, you're going to be basting it. And when you baste it, don't be afraid to test it at the middle of that, either the dressing inside, which will be the last thing to get warm, or even in the, depending on the size of the turkey, in the middle of the breast itself will give you an accurate temperature. And you never want to go over 160 on a turkey.
Okay, well,
always have a contingency plan, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was originally where the idea of having a turkey and a ham came from, just in case.
just in case you messed up on that.
And always have lots of vegetables and mashed potatoes as well.
Yes, yes. Now, we've been talking about, you know, a fairly traditional Thanksgiving with a whole bunch of family, you know, 20, 25 people. What about if it's just, let's say, two couples having a dinner? What would you suggest?
Well, you know, there are so many alternatives, of which we carry them all down at Key City. But I often love doing a goose, you know, or a duck. If I'm doing duck, they're usually like 5 pounds a piece, so I'll usually do one duck per two people, you know, and I'll roast it whole, and I'll stuff it, and I like to do like a wild grain and any fresh herbs that you have in your garden, depending on, like, there are certain ones like rosemary can be overwhelming, sage can be overwhelming, things that you want to use sparingly, and other things like basil that kind of blend themselves in with whatever you're cooking. But what I like to do with a duck or even a goose is do a wild rice stuffing inside of that, you know, with a brown grain. And then your wild rice is usually, it's a product that's raised in Michigan, which is very tough grain. So you're going to cook that about an hour in watching your chicken stock and making sure that you get it to where it actually turns out of itself and it becomes very tender. But it has a really nice grainy flavor and texture that really enhance the quality of the dark meat of the bird. I would also like to add that doing duck or goose, you want to make sure that you have it on a rack out of its own oils and juices. That's not to say that you don't want to still baste your birds with the oils and juices so that they get a nice crisp texture to the skin before you serve it. But, there's certain tricks like that where the dark meat, you want to make sure that everybody's kind of likes to have dark meat because it's not gamey, but it is dark.
Yeah,
kind of like all turkey-like kind
right,
of, you know.
Right, okay. So with the duck, with the crispy skin and the wild rice stuffing, what would be a nice complimentary dishes to have for that meal?
Is convenient sometime when you're having a small group of people so you can get more creative on like your vegetables. You know that they're going to be eaten when they're served, whereas if you're feeding 20, they're going to have to sit for a while.
Right.
So you're going to use a hot plate or whatever. But there is nothing better than with that wild rice stuffing to do fresh asparagus and garlic butter and lay them over the top of the rice. Eat with our eyes first. So you always want to plate your food up accordingly, so that it's visually appealing. And then if you did it right and it's up and the flavor is right too, then you've won twice,
I like that expression, you eat with your eyes first. That's really interesting. Okay, so some people don't really necessarily want to do the poultry thing, and they're carnivorous. So what about a prime rib?
Okay, we offer, down at Key City, we offer some beautiful prime rib. We use only what is known as a country natural beef selection down there, and it's all pasture raised, no hormones, no antibiotics, none of the stuff that we don't, no GMO corn, any of that. And when you're looking at beef, the quality of the beef is graded, like they say, USDA and stuff and choice and all that. It's all graded by how marbled the beef is, which is a process at the end of its living its life. They're using a natural corn and they're fattening the meat up with a marble in between. A good example of that is a product called Wagyu beef from Japan.
I've heard of that.
And what they do is they raise their beef so different from how we do it, where it's a pampered stock. They literally feed it beer all of its life. The animals are massaged daily.
Wow.
And what that does is, if you've ever seen a piece of corned beef, how marbled the meat is in with the lean part of the roast, that's exactly how all of the Wagyu comes out. And because they're not allowed to ship it out, they have other farms now, like in Australia, where they're raising it under the same pretense. They're raising it at the same values because they're not allowed to ship it out of Japan. So
Why is that a government regulation?
Huh. Exactly.
But is there no one here in the U.S. doing the same thing?
No. When I get mine down at the shop, I mostly get it from New Zealand or Australia.
Interesting. You'd think some enterprising American would take this up. There's probably a market for it.
Exactly. But, it's like the Japanese have been doing it for thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so we as Americans are more into turnover. Getting it done.
Okay, well, getting back to our holiday feast of prime rib, what about the rest of the menu?
So
what would you suggest?
The standing rib roast, which is also known as the Golden Lion, is called that because you're leaving the rib in, and when you're baking it, you're setting the arched rib on the pan. What that does is it gives it a more even heat to the whole roast. When you're setting a roast on the pan, you're literally frying the side that's touching the pan. So by having that arched rib in there, you're actually, the heat is more conductive around the thing and not actually searing it from one side or the other. So what we do down there, and we have a large following where they come in an order for New Year's or for Christmas, and what I do is, because it's so inconvenient to have that rib on there, what our customers will do is they'll order however many people they are going to have, and then I find out how many ribs that equals out. And then what we do is we cut that off. We take the rib off of the roast itself, and then we tie it back on. So you still get the quality of having the bone cooked with the meat on it, which adds more flavor. And then once she's ready to serve, she just has to cut three strings, and the rib comes off. And oddly enough, there are people that really like those beef ribs, so it kind of serves two purposes. So.
Okay, and I know you're a big fan of the meat thermometer.
I am.
What would be the correct temperature
for... if you are cooking a prime rib, first off, you're going to get a feeling of your guest, how many of them like it well done, how many like it medium rare. I usually always hit a perfect 120, and the core of that prime rib is medium rare perfect. So if everybody's at medium rare or rare, then you're going to want to hit it at 110.
Okay.
And when you're cooking it, so you're going to hit your oven at about 350, make sure it's preheated. Have a good coat of seasoning salt or a sauce over it, so that what that seasoning salt does is it creates a bond on the outside of the prime rib so that all your juices are contained inside. So once it's reached that 130 or 120, however much you want, so perfect medium rare is 120. Once you've cooked it for that length of time, you're going to want to take it and set it and let it rest before serving.
How long do you need to?
What that depends on is how big of a roast, obviously, you're doing. The main thing is to understand why you're actually resting it. When it's cooking, the molecules are pushing out. Things are being excreted, which is also why we do that coat of salt around the outside. So once it has come to its temperature, what you want to do is you want to set it out for 10 to 15 minutes after it's done hitting your peak number that you want to hit, and let it rest for 10 to 15 minutes so that what's happening then is the molecules are not pushing out anymore. It's actually contracting. It's drawing those juices back into the roast, which is where you want it, so that when you carve, you're not getting a pool of blood on the plate from the moisture still excreting.
So it doesn't really keep cooking then, right?
No, once you pull it out, you're gonna hit that 120, and that's where it's going from that. So there's a process. There's another type of oven called an Alto-Sham that's used in professional kitchens. And so as opposed to putting a piece of beef in at 40 degrees, which is where you're maintaining the temperature at till you go in, what you're doing with an Alto-Sham is it is not a heat source at the bottom of the oven. It is a circulatory heat, so it's got elements all around it. So what you do, as opposed to hitting your oven at 350, this oven heats it to what you want the internal temperature to be. So it is cooking for like 5 hours at 120 perfect. So when you pull that prime rib out, it doesn't have to be rested. Huh. It is literally ready to go.
Most of us don't have access to that.
Yeah,
that's sort of a professional thing.
Yeah, and definitely right.
But, okay, holiday cooking can be very stressful on people.
Yes.
Do you have any tips to make it a little less stressful?
Well, yeah, good planning is always foremost. Like, for instance, if somebody has allergies or something to that effect, something that they can't eat, a good host will know to check, or would hopefully get informed by the person that has these allergies,
right?
That is there, and then they will perform and they will put together a special dish for them. As far as pre-planning, it's always nice to have some appetizers that would be advantageous for if dinner isn't quite out on time, which we all know about.
Yeah, that does happen at times.
But mainly know your guest, I think, is my best thought on that.
Okay. If people often volunteer to bring things, is that a good idea?
Yes, it's a really good idea. Usually that is the day after Thanksgiving. And what you want to do is kind of like have a gift register like you do with a wedding or a shower or something like that, where you're kind of collaborating who's going to bring what so that everybody doesn't show up with turkey and old dressing, because Lord knows that's usually what we have the most of left over. So that way you can delegate salads, pasta salads, you know, starches, greens. So, you know,
have a master plan.
Yes, exactly. And it's only courteous to the people that are coming as well. Because that way they all know what they're doing. And structure in a meal is really nice. I mean, it's kind of the behind-the-scenes structure of a meal that counts.
Right. Okay. Now, here's another puzzler. Mm-hmm. Is it a good idea to offer to let people take some leftovers home, or should you just keep it all to yourself?
I always share what I have, but I'm notorious for always having too much. So, you know, yeah, I always highly recommend. It's even more than just a courtesy. It's kind of like the next day they get to relive the meal that they had, and it'll bring back culinary memories, and maybe it'll enhance them to do something different for their next occasion.
Well, you know, some culinary memories are pretty weird. I mean, I remember one time my uncle and I, we had one of those tin foil pans, and we were lifting it out together, one from each side, and the damn thing went onto the floor. Now, the good news about this is no one saw it.
Yeah, the 3-second rule, right?
Right, you know, right. Like,
even though it was a whole bird.
Yes, yes.
And luckily, you didn't have it overcooked, because if it were overcooked and you dropped it, it would just be
splatter.
A disaster.
Splatter. Yeah, well, everyone has a few of these stories.
Yes. And good planning, again, is the answer to that. Like, instead of taking, you know, your foil, aluminum, it's warm. It's going to have different tensile strength. So you take the whole rack out and, you know, use that. But, again, common sense with just about any of this is a good
yes,
plan.
Yes, yes. You know? All right. Well, Daniel, believe it or not, we're nearing the end of our time here. And I really want to thank you for being on the show. We have been talking about holiday meals, and Daniel Knudsen from Key City has given us some great ideas on cooking and menus. And any last tips you have?
Cook from the heart. I think is, you know, even if you make a mistake, people know when there's love involved with what's cooking, which is what my whole premise has been all through my culinary thing, is what love goes in comes out as well. And with that thought, I'd like to thank all my loyal customers down at Key City Fish, John Paul, and all the staff that I work with, because if it weren't for that working people appreciating what I do, it wouldn't be worth anything, you know? So that's about my best advice. Cook with love.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show. Really appreciate it. You have been listening to Our Town on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Our Town features some of the dynamic, eclectic people who make up this community. My name's Marianne McNellis. My guest, Daniel Knudsen. We have been talking about holiday meals, and we hope you and yours all have lovely holiday season. If you missed part of this show and you want to hear it again, go to our website. It will be up as a podcast. Our website is kptz.org. Meanwhile, keep listening to this station, KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM, for more dynamic, eclectic community programming.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production created by Marianne McNellis and engineered by Sonny Flores.